This is Audible.
Whole Story Quest Audiobooks presents Two Old Fools on a Camel by Victoria Tweed, narrated by Jilly Bond. Chapter 1. Footprints in the Sand. Do you think we'll see camels wandering the streets, like those elephants we saw when we went to Bangkok? I asked.
I don't know.
Joe was lost in his own thoughts. Perhaps some of the kids will come to school on camels.
Maybe.
We were on the last leg of our journey from Spain to Bahrain. I peered out of the plane's porthole. Far below us, the sea stretched endlessly, the early morning sun transforming the blue into gold. The Persian Gulf, how exotic! We were stopped at Madrid airport and nearly refused permission to board, because without the correct visas we couldn't enter Bahrain. Deep down, I'd willed the authorities to send us home to our little Spanish village of El Hoyo. But the airport staff had phoned our Bahraini employers, the American Specialist School, or ASS, and somehow the problem melted away. Our journey to the Middle East continued. "That's it," I squeaked. "I think that's Bahrain." Joe leaned over me to share my view. As our plane descended, the map-like view of the island below sprang into detail. Skyscrapers, metallic and gleaming, multi-lane highways, snaking sand roads, flat-roofed buildings and houses, glimpses of tempting-looking swimming pools, all in miniature, but growing larger. The land was flat, dusty, and yellow. Everything looked baked, even though it was barely 7 a.m. Then the runway opened up in front of us, and we landed with a bump. "That's it," I said again. "We're here." We passed smoothly through customs and purchased temporary visas. Reunited with our luggage, we made our way to the exit doors. Both of us were silent, drinking in the foreign sights and smells. I tried not to stare at the white-robed Arabs with their expensive leather luggage, trailed by wives in black flowing abayas, only their eyes visible behind burqas. In stark contrast, Indian workers milled about, dressed in simple robes or tattered Western clothes. I was pleased to see a few Europeans and Americans, and felt a little calmer. Once through the doors, the heat hit us like a giant fist. My body instantly broke out into a most unladylike sweat. Droplets poured down my scalp, through my hair, and ran down my neck. We had only just emerged from the air-conditioned coolness of the airport building, and already my clothes stuck damply to me.
"My word," Joe breathed. "I've never felt heat like this before. Not in Spain, not in Thailand, not even Australia."
Perspiration ran down his face unchecked. "I agree. And it's still early morning. Darina did warn us." Darina was the new principal of the high school, Joe's future boss, and we'd formed an online friendship. She'd arrived in Bahrain a week earlier and had frequently emailed us.
"So,"
said Joe, scratching his nethers irritably,
"wasn't somebody supposed to meet us here?"
We searched the thinning crowds. Nobody appeared to be looking for us. "Never mind," I said. "We've got the address. We'll just take a taxi." Secretly, I was quite relieved. I needed a shower and change of clothes before meeting anybody. We approached the line of taxis, and I couldn't resist searching for tethered camels. Sadly, I didn't see a single one. A white-robed Arab, with white headdress, detached himself from a group and ushered us into his taxi. The car was modern, clean and air-conditioned. Gratefully, we sank into the comfortable seats.
"Look,"
I whispered.
"He's even got a feather duster to keep his cap clean."
I didn't know then that the feather duster on the dashboard served another purpose. The journey to our hotel took nearly an hour, which surprised me. Previously, I'd located both hotel and airport on a map, and they hadn't seemed so far apart. Our driver never spoke as we drove along wide, well-maintained avenues lined with palm trees and crossed modern bridges. Joe and I occasionally nudged each other, pointing out sites of interest. As we approached the city of Manama, the buildings became skyscrapers, stretching up to the empty blue sky. Vast white stone sculptures adorned the highway, including one that looked familiar from my internet research. This one had massive curved legs and supported a huge stone ball. Beneath it, a water fountain played. It stood in the centre of a large roundabout, the intersection of many motorways.
Joe, look! That's quite a famous statue, the Pearl Monument. The ball on the top represents a pearl and reminds people of what Bahrain used to trade.
Yes, I see it. Vicky, are you sure you gave the driver the right address? We seem to have been in this taxi for hours.
Quite sure.
Darina had already told me that the teachers would be accommodated in a hotel before being moved into brand new apartments that the school was building for us. Darina told me the new apartments will be ready in a week or so. This hotel is just a temporary measure. Signposts were written in English and Arabic. Traffic was heavy, and every car seemed to be more expensive, larger and cleaner than the last.
How do they keep their cars so clean in this dust? I wondered. And what are those round doughnut shapes burnt into the road?
We passed shops and restaurants, all closed. We passed many shopping malls, advertising familiar brands, Marks and Spencer, Virgin, Starbucks, Kentucky Fried Chicken. I wondered what time they opened. At last the taxi stopped in front of a tall building with dark-tinted windows. The driver helped Joe pile up the luggage on the roadside. There was no pavement, and sweat poured from Joe's brow, dripping down his nose and into the soft desert sand.
"How much is that?"
Joe asked, opening his wallet.
"That'll be 17 bidi,"
said the driver, avoiding eye contact.
"That sounds very reasonable,"
said Joe, handing the driver one of our crisp new 20 bidi Bahraini dinar notes, decorated with a smiling King Hamad on one side and a splendid mosque on the other.
"Keep the change."
While Joe and the driver had been manhandling the luggage, I'd been reading the stickers inside the cab. One said something like, "By law, all taxi fares depend on the meter reading. If the driver does not use the meter, you should not pay." I looked for the meter and discovered it, obscured by the feather duster on the dashboard.
"That taxi was a bargain, wasn't it?"
said Joe as the taxi roared away, throwing up clouds of sand.
"I only paid him 20 bidi.
I wasn't so sure. I said nothing then, but checked later. My suspicions were correct. At the very most, the trip should have lasted 20 minutes, and 20 bidi translated to about £34 or $53. We had been taken for a ride. Literally. The fare should have been between 3 and 5 bidi. The sun beat down without mercy. I stared at my feet as I stood in the sand, my shoes already covered in a layer of dust. Perhaps it was the long journey, and tiredness, but I was transfixed by my footprints in the sand. First impressions. I blamed Joe, of course. It was August 2010, and our lives had just been spun upside down. It was Joe who wanted to work with children for one last time before retiring for good. It was Joe who'd surfed the internet and found us jobs in the Middle East. It was Joe who'd pointed out that, thanks to the credit crisis, our funds were low, and unless we earned some serious money, we'd be unable to pay our bills. Technology is a wonderful thing. Everything was arranged online. We'd applied for teaching jobs, been accepted, and our flight e-tickets had arrived in our email inbox. And everything we knew about Bahrain was what we'd gleaned from the internet. We knew that it was a fabulously wealthy country, with a royal family, and were happy to read that it was peaceful. It was described as tolerant, unlike its closest neighbour, Saudi Arabia, connected to Bahrain by a causeway. There was no Ministry of Virtue, the infamous religious police in Bahrain, and women were permitted to drive cars and work. Women were not forced to wear the all-covering abayas or burqas, although most did. Even alcohol was legal and available for non-Muslims, if one knew where to look. We knew that expats accounted for a large proportion of the population of Bahrain, attracted by the high earnings. Bahrain's fortunes had originally come from pearl fishing, then oil, but now it had become one of the major financial hubs of the world. Also, we knew that the USA Navy kept their fifth fleet in Bahrain. We knew that we wouldn't have to pay taxes, that our accommodation, transport to school, healthcare and flights would all be paid for by our employers. All this knowledge was comforting, and we felt sure we'd made the right decision. Perhaps we'd enjoy our new life so much that we'd stay longer than the 1 year we'd agreed to. How could we guess that we were catapulting ourselves into events that would soon dominate world news? But no words could describe the wrench of leaving our crazy little Spanish mountain village behind. Waving goodbye to our village of friends was excruciatingly painful. Turning our backs on our home, friends, chickens, animals, and the rolling, ever-changing Spanish mountains was heartbreaking, but necessary if we were to survive financially. Perhaps it was a good thing that the whole process, from application to arrival in Bahrain, had taken just 2 weeks. Two short, frantic weeks hadn't allowed us enough time to brood over our decision, to get cold feet, or change our minds. So here we were, in August, the hottest month of the year, standing outside a strange hotel in Bahrain. A smiling Indian hotel porter burst from the reception area to claim our luggage. The receptionist took our details and consulted a computer. Joe and I stood waiting, more than a little shell-shocked and exhausted, after our journey halfway around the world. "Ah, yes," said the male receptionist, looking up. "Mr. Rina asked for you to have this suite opposite her. Your room number is 748. We whooshed up 7 floors in the lift with the porter. "American?" he asked, revealing a single yellow tooth that pointed up like a tombstone. "No, British." He unlocked our door with a flourish and ushered us inside. The suite was nice, if a little old-fashioned. 2 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, a spacious living room, and a decent kitchen. The furniture was bulky and dark, the curtains thick and heavy, doing a grand job of blocking the outside glare and heat. Toothy fussed with the curtains, tested the lights, opened and shut every door, and finally stood still, hand outstretched, face frozen into what he may have thought an attractive smile.
"He wants a tip,"
I hissed to Joe. Joe fumbled out 5BD, and Toothy backed out of the suite, bowing at regular intervals. Joe had given him £8.50, $14, and Toothy probably thought Christmas or Diwali had come early. We were exhausted. Joe used the bathroom. He calls it marking his territory. We washed, then collapsed into bed, despite it being just 10 a.m. We laid our heads on Egyptian cotton pillows and instantly fell asleep. But not for long. I was roused by a knocking noise. Somebody was tapping urgently on our door. I forced my eyes open and wondered where I was. This bedroom, with its huge bed, many wardrobes, marble floors and ensuite bathroom, looked nothing like our familiar cave bedroom in Spain. Of course... We were in Bahrain. I sat up and poked Joe.
"Joe, there's somebody at the door."
"Probably Toothy. Go back to sleep."
"Whoever it is, he's knocking again.
I'll have to go." Chapter 2. A Party. I pulled on a bathrobe and staggered to the door. The knocking had become more insistent. I tried peering through the peephole, but saw nothing but a blur. I pulled the door open, and the visitor fell in with a startled squeak, landing in a crumpled heap at my feet. It definitely wasn't Toothy.
Vicky, it's me, Dorina.
Oh. I reached out a hand and helped her to her feet, not easy as she was wearing heels high enough to require a stepladder. So this was the headmistress of the high school, Joe's new boss? As she dusted herself off, I had the chance to look at the lady I'd been communicating with for the past couple of weeks. We were the same age, and I liked her immediately. Dorina was an attractive lady, blonde and beautifully dressed. Her emails, arriving in quick succession, warm and unedited, had already given me a hint of her personality. In real life, she was the same, full of energy, with a breathless way of speaking. I was to discover that Dorina was almost childlike, bubbling with enthusiasm, always cheerful, generous and thoughtful, but unfortunately a little inclined to make rash decisions. However, her giddiness hid a fine brain. Her dedication to her job was often misinterpreted, and I was to find myself caught in the middle of awkward situations many times in the months to come. We embraced. Joe and I had much for which to thank Dorina. She had helped us with our applications, insisting that our ages were an asset, not a hurdle. The school had agreed, but it was the Ministry of Education, the overriding authority, that needed convincing. Luckily, permission was granted. The staff at the desk told me you'd arrived. How was your journey? Have you explored yet? What do you think of your rooms? Where's Joe? I filled her in on all the details. Right, she said. It's Ramadan, so everything is closed at the moment, but the stores will open at sundown. I'll show you our nearest supermarket. It's pretty good. It's just a shame that it's Ramadan. Then the school is taking all the newbies on a night tour of Manama. I've done it already, so I won't go. Tomorrow, there's another tour of Bahrain, and the next day there's a big meeting at school. You'll be able to take a good look around. Just listening to that agenda exhausted me. And although I knew that we'd arrived during Ramadan, I hadn't understood how that would affect us. I was to find out later. Dorina left, and I was about to head for the bedroom and resume my nap, when a note was pushed under our door. I picked it up and read it. Joe and I had been invited to a meet-and-greet later, hosted by someone called Dr. Cecily, at her apartment across the sand lot. But for now, all I could think about was sleep. Joe and I are not partygoers by choice, but we felt that we should make an appearance, and it would be a good opportunity to meet our fellow teachers. Reluctantly, we trudged across the sand lot and entered the apartment block. We tapped on the door, and a buzz of noise from the meet-and-greet escaped as the door opened. We were shown into a spacious lounge, which by now only had standing room. A table was laden with party food, and to my surprise plenty of alcohol was on offer. Most people were drinking beer or wine.
"And your name is?"
drawled our hostess, Dr. Cecily, her eyes firmly focused on a point somewhere on the ceiling. She was a stout, imposing figure. She had no neck, and her head and body moved as a single unit. I wasn't exactly sure who she was, but she possessed an air of authority.
"I'm Vicky, and this is Joe."
Dr. Cecily's head and body turned to face Joe, her eyes fixed on a different part of the ceiling.
"Joe's teaching maths and physics in the high school, and I'm in the middle school teaching English."
"Well, I sure am pleased to meet you both,"
said Dr. Cecily, addressing the light fitting, and walked away before she'd even finished her sentence.
"I'm going to mingle," I whispered to Joe. "See you later."
I searched for Dorina, but she wasn't there.
"Come and sit with us," said a voice. "There's space here."
The owner of the voice was a large lady, even larger than Dr. Cecily, and she was patting a tiny vacancy on the sofa between herself and another plump lady.
"I'm Dawn. And this is Rita."
Rita was even larger than Dawn. With difficulty, I squeezed myself into the hot gap and looked around. All these new teachers. Apart from Dr. Cecily, Dawn and Rita, I calculated their average age must have been about 24. I felt very old. These young things were on the brink of their careers, while Joe and I were finishing ours. "I see that Dorina, the high school principal, isn't here," I said to Dawn after our introductions. "She's new too, isn't she?" Stony silence. "It's her first year too, isn't it?" I persisted, perhaps a little unwisely. "Miss Dorina wasn't invited," said Rita. I saw her exchange glances and raised eyebrows with Dr. Cecily and Dawn. I sensed a grudge lurking somewhere, but as yet was unable to fathom the cause. It seemed that Dr. Cecily was responsible for hiring most of the new teachers, as a result of a job fair in Middle America. Every voice was American, apart from ours, and I remembered very few of the names or faces. There was, however, one exception. Brent. I first noticed Brent when he was talking to Joe. Joe is 6 feet tall, but Brent was taller. I guessed that he was about 30 years of age. He had a mane of unruly hair growing untidily around a central bald patch, and instead of a can of beer or wine glass, he clutched a notebook and pencil. Perhaps he was a reporter? I excused myself from the three fat ladies, extracting myself with difficulty from the suffocating depths of the sofa. "Please, what is your name, please?" Brent was asking Joe.
"I'm Joe."
Joe extended his hand, but Brent chose to ignore it. "Please, how do you spell that, please?"
J-O-E.
Brent scribbled in his notebook and looked up again.
"And where do you come from, please?"
"I'm British, but actually we live in Sp—"
"And what will you be teaching, please?"
Scribble, scribble.
"High school maths and physics."
"Hello, I'm Vicky," I said, joining them and smiling at Brent. "I'm Joe's better half." Brent swung round to face me. I tried shaking hands, but he ignored me, too. Joe rolled his eyes and shook his head.
"Please, what is your name, please?"
"I'm Vicky."
"Please, how do you spell that, please?"
V-I-C-K-Y.
"And where do you come from, please?"
Scribble, scribble. "England, via Spain."
"And what will you be teaching, please?"
"English." Brent wrote, then turned away from us to face a young couple, cutting into their conversation.
"Please, what is your name, please?"
"Who was that?"
I whispered to Joe.
"A reporter?"
"No, that's Brent, teaching talk in the high school. I think he's a bit of a weirdo."
"Oh, what's talk?"
"Theory of knowledge."
"Oh."
I was out of my depth and felt a wave of homesickness for El Hoyo, for our house, for the chickens, her neighbours, for the simple life. What were we doing in this alien place, with these strange people? The front door opened again, and an attractive veiled Arabic lady entered. The three fat ladies welcomed her and introduced her to the room.
"This is Miss Naima, Head of Human Resources," announced Dr. Cecily.
Miss Naima smiled, looked down at the wad of brown envelopes in her hand, and then started calling out names. Her English was accented but excellent. Our names were called, we stepped forward, and she handed us our envelopes. Impatient as ever, Joe peeked into his envelope, and his eyes widened.
"It's money," he said. "Lots of it."
"Okay, y'all,"
called Dr. Cecily, officiously clapping her hands.
"Miss Naima has just given you your settling-in allowance. Now let's get this show on the road. The school bus is waiting below to take y'all on your night tour of the city."
Joe and I were first out of the door, but when we reached the waiting bus, Joe kept on walking.
"Make some excuse for me,"
he said over his shoulder.
"I can't face any more polite small talk. Take some photos, tell me how you get on. I promise I'll come on the trip tomorrow."
I sighed. This wasn't unusual. Since his military days, Joe had developed an allergy to crowds. I watched him march away across the sand and boarded the bus alone, just as the evening prayer chants began. A wail floated from a minaret above a mosque. Then another. then more, all from different directions of the city, filling the air. I looked at a large building opposite, decorated with a giant picture of the king, several floors high. The king smiled benevolently down upon his subjects, and more than ever I felt like a fish out of water. The others now boarded the bus. I was a little surprised at the condition of the interior. Some seats were slashed, and graffiti scrawls were evident.
"The students,"
explained a fat lady who caught me staring.
"They're spoilt, those kids. They just do whatever they want. They know somebody will clean up after them."
The driver started the engine, and we set off across the sand lot, heading for the road. I'd noticed that the Bahrainis seemed to build their apartment blocks first, not concerning themselves with paving the roads until later, if ever. I don't recall much of the tour. I know I saw brightly lit mosques, mouths, the Pearl Monument, again, and the famous financial district with its modern towers. Most of the time I just watched neon signs flash past in a blur. I should have been excited, but I felt homesick and deeply lonely. The three fat ladies pointed chubby fingers at buildings and landmarks, rarely pausing in their running commentary. The youngsters on the bus chattered and squealed. For them it was a huge adventure. Newly qualified, most had never travelled. And I could hear Brent with his, "Please, what is your name, please?" repeated over and over. Little did I know that not many seats away from me were two of the greatest friends Joe and I would ever make. Colton and Jake, younger than our own kids, would delight us and transform our days in the Middle East. And there was somebody else on that bus whom I instantly liked, and who would play a big part in our everyday lives. It was Jassim, the bus driver, and I was to discover that his mood would affect every one of our days at the school. At last the tour was over, and I rejoined Joe in our hotel suite. He was fiddling about with the TV, unable to find many English-speaking programs.
"Did you see any camels?"
he asked. I shook my head and went to bed. Perhaps things would look brighter in the morning. Tomorrow was going to be another very busy day. Next morning, we woke well-rested and ready to face the day. We had coffee, and I was reading the hotel's rules and information when I made a discovery. Hey, the hotel has a swimming pool! Things were looking up. Joe and I had plenty of time before being picked up by the bus for our next sightseeing tour. More than enough time for a swim. We grabbed our stuff and took the lift to the roof. We passed the gymnasium with averted eyes. This was not a place in which we intended spending much time. We pushed the door to the open-air pool and squealed as we touched the metal handrail. It was hot enough to grill a chorizo. Somebody else was already in the small pool. A fit young man swam up and down, up and down. Brent. Joe and I settled ourselves on sun loungers, waiting for Brent to tire. But he didn't. Eventually we could stand the heat no longer and slipped into the shallow end, only to find that the water was hot. Far from being refreshing, it was more like swimming in soup.
"Hello, Brent,"
Joe said cheerfully, as Brent slowed to turn.
"Please, what is your name, please?"
"I'm Joe. We met last night. And where do you come from, please?"
Joe gave up and started swimming. We swam a while, then departed, leaving Brent to continue with his lengths, up and down, up and down, up and down. Jassim arrived more than half an hour late to pick us up for our next sightseeing trip. Joe was annoyed, but it was a taste of things to come. Chapter 3. Sand, sand everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Arriving late did not bother our bus driver, Jassim, at all. Jassim came when Jassim was ready, not before. And if Jassim was in a good mood, the journey was smooth. However, if Jassim was unhappy, we'd soon know about it. He'd rattle our bones as the bus lurched through the sand, wrenching the steering wheel from side to side, causing us to be thrown around like dried peas in a box. He'd ignore traffic lights, and every corner became a fairground ride. The itinerary of our sightseeing trip looked interesting. We were going to the museum, the Grand Mosque, the Formula One racetrack, and, best of all, to see the King's camels. By now many of the teachers had become familiar to us, although new ones were arriving all the time. We avoided Brent as far as possible, but others we liked and chatted with. Darina didn't join us, as she was spending her time at the school and had already seen the sights. I heard her name frequently mentioned by the three fat ladies, Cecily, Dawn and Rita, our self-appointed sightseeing guides. And, judging by their frowns and whispered exchanges, Darina was not the flavour of the month. This astonished me, as Darina had not yet begun her job as principal. The heat was indescribable, and the air-conditioned interior of the bus was our sanctuary, but we all streamed out obediently to mill around the museum. Joe was fascinated, but I couldn't find much enthusiasm for the few 6,000-year-old unrecognisable artefacts. Everything looked dry and shrivelled. Joe tried to pique my interest by showing me a restored Buick, donated by the American government in 1932. He failed miserably. At the beautiful Grand Mosque, or Alfa Ate, which I recognised from the 20 BD banknote, we all removed our shoes. The females of the party were ushered into an anteroom, where we were issued with all covering abayas and hijabs, without which we would not be granted access. The mosque was only 22 years old, sparsely furnished and decorated, unlike Christian places of worship. We all sat on the carpet under a vast fiberglass dome, listening to an imam's lecture. My concentration was thin. I was more interested in studying fellow members of our party, and two little girls, with only their faces visible, playing on a bench. By the time we'd visited the museum and the Grand Mosque, Joe and I were parched. There was nowhere to buy a drink. Everything was closed. And now we understood why. Ramadan. No food or drink, not even a sip of water, was permitted between sunrise and sunset. Not being Muslim, we could eat and drink, but only in private, for fear of offending the devout.
"Okay, y'all," said one of the three fat ladies. "We're going to the Formula One racetrack now."
The news was greeted with damp enthusiasm by the passengers, who were hot and irritable. But not Joe.
"Crikey! The Bahrain F1 racetrack!" he yelled. "I can't believe I'm actually going to see it!"
Joe is a huge fan of the Grand Prix, and this was the highlight of his day. I noticed other teachers giving him sidelong glances, and I guessed Formula One was not high on their interest list. The sun hammered down as just a handful of us left the cool bus to explore the circuit. Apart from us, the grounds were deserted.
"Vicky, can you believe it? Look, there's the starting grid. And the pits. Wow!
I can't wait for March when the Bahrain Grand Prix is on. Did you know that Bahrain is hosting the opening round of the season?"
Joe's head was beetroot red, caused by a mixture of heat and excitement. I like F1, but not enough to stand in the searing heat admiring the track's bends and grandstand. All I really wanted was a drink. Even my enthusiasm to see the King's camels was fast diminishing. Back on the bus, Jazim made an announcement, gold teeth glinting through his broad grin.
"Today not go see King's camels."
"Why not?"
asked Joe.
"Very hot. Too much hot."
I was disappointed, but going home was attractive. I was hallucinating about our fridge's interior, and the glasses of cold water that I would soon be pouring down my throat. The camels would have to wait. Tomorrow we'd visit the school for the first time. We'd meet the owners, check out the facilities, and see our classrooms. I was more than a little nervous. Vicky, I don't understand it. I'm getting no support at all from Dr. Cecily, Dawn, or Reader. In fact, they block everything I suggest. Dorina was already a constant visitor to our suite, and she frequently reported back, providing us with juicy snippets of the school's preparation for the new term. The three fat ladies? Dorina chuckled.
Is that what you call them?
Good name. Well, I don't know what's going on there, but I'll try to find out, I said. I remembered witnessing the three fat ladies' hostility towards Dorina at the meet-and-greet party. Perhaps our first school visit would shed some light on the mystery. And wait until you meet the owner, Mrs. Sherazy.
Why?
Wait and see. I have to give a speech, too.
And you'll meet your middle school principal, Mr. Brewster.
What's he like?
He seems okay. He's American, of course. A man of color. He seems a bit on the defensive, and I'm not sure why.
At 7 a.m. the next morning, it was already hot. I'd hidden a bottle of water in my bag, knowing there would be no refreshments during the day. Ramadan was a harsh time. Jazim, the bus driver, was late, and we waited for him in the cool of the hotel foyer. Our favourites, Jake and Colton, kept us amused with tales of their hometowns. Jake was from Chicago, and Colton hailed from Boise, Idaho. This was Jake's first teaching position, and he had arrived in Bahrain with his lovely girlfriend, Emily, full of hopes and ambition. Fair-haired, polite, with a competitive streak, Jake was a born showman and teacher. His stories and his ability to mimic fellow teachers, including Brent and the three fat ladies, often left us weak with laughter. Jake had presence. Everybody gravitated towards him, and he was popular with Arabs and Westerners alike. This was Colton's first year of teaching, too. Having completed his college education, he became a waiter in a Boise restaurant. He was hugely successful, earning money hand over fist, but decided serving was not enough. He trained to become a teacher and accepted the offer from the American Specialist School, or ASS. Colton was impossibly good-looking, but never vain. He had the kind of face that could have originated from anywhere, Arabia, Spain, America, wherever. His brown eyes sparkled with fun, but he never took himself very seriously. He attracted female attention wherever he went, but it was not only his looks that attracted. Colton was gentle, sensitive, generous, and incredibly thoughtful. In spite of their age difference, Joe and Colton soon developed a special bond, and later would spend hours together, watching movies, arguing, talking about nothing, and roaring with laughter. Later on, both Colton and Jake became popular with the students, although their classroom styles were poles apart. Jake was strict and ran a tight ship, although humour was an important part of his delivery. Colton, on the other hand, was relaxed and friendly with his students, and they adored him. Both were extremely effective teachers. The other young teachers milled about, some leaning against walls, all chatting. Brent was there, notebook at the ready. I saw him closing in, pencil poised, but luckily the bus arrived. I steered Joe away before Brent had the chance to ask our names yet again. Jasmine was in a good mood, and that first drive to school was fascinating. 40 years ago, the area where our hotel was located was under the sea. The land was reclaimed, and modern skyscrapers sprouted up where once there had only been water. The houses were large, expensive, and hidden behind walls, with only their upper floors visible. We caught glimpses through ornate gates of Indian servants washing cars or watering flowerbeds. Between houses lay sand lots, no doubt earmarked for future construction. Now and then we stopped to pick up teachers, already veterans at the school, who chose to live in preferred accommodation. Although the school was quite close to our hotel, the frequent stops and heavy traffic turned a 10-minute journey into one of half an hour. We swung off the main road and left the tall, opulent buildings and gated compounds behind. Now the road was narrow and dusty. Here the houses were low, flat-roofed, cramped and crumbling, often festooned with black flags. Arabic graffiti adorned bare walls. In a few short weeks, we were to discover that the graffiti spelled out political messages, like freedom. Our school lurked behind very high walls topped with wire fencing, and we could see nothing except huge metal gates guarded by uniformed security men. I don't really know what I'd been expecting, but the building looked more like a prison than a school. We piled out and passed through the gates into a courtyard. The main classroom block was 3 floors high and, together with a few administration blocks, surrounded the large, partly shaded courtyard. I tried to imagine the place filled with Arabic kids, as it soon would be. The 3 fat ladies herded us into an administration block and introduced us to the square gadget fixed to a wall.
"Hey, y'all, this is where you punch in every morning and punch out at the end of the day."
Joe and I exchanged glances. So we were expected to clock in and out every day. I hadn't done that since I worked on a factory assembly line making fire guards when I was a student.
"And if you're late 3 times, y'all lose a day's pay."
"And if you're sick, you need to call in yourself and explain, or y'all lose a day's pay. And if you don't have a doctor's note, y'all lose a day's pay."
As we digested this, the 3 fat ladies led the way across the courtyard to the main classroom block. Once through the entrance doors, we saw large portraits of the king and his uncle, the prime minister, prominently displayed on notice boards. Straight ahead, a flight of stairs led to the upper floors. To the left, and above a swing door, was written Middle School. Opposite, and above another swing door, High School. The kindergarten, elementary school and gymnasium were in separate buildings across the street, we were told. In total, the school accommodated more than 1,500 children. We were led up the stairs to the first floor and ushered into an auditorium large enough to seat about 500 in neat rows. And then the meetings began. Whether in the UK, America or the Middle East, I'm sure school staff meetings are pretty similar. But the meetings we endured that day were lengthy, made twice as long because everything was announced in Arabic and then repeated in English. Brent sat in front of us, on his own, pen and notebook poised.
"Welcome to ASS, the American Specialist School,"
Dr. Cecily said into the microphone.
"Where all students succeed," chanted the veteran teachers, led by the 3 fat ladies.
Joe and I looked at each other. Was this an American thing? None of the staff meetings in England incorporated jingoistic chants. Further along from us, Jake and Colton appeared unconcerned. Must be an American thing, I concluded. Dr. Cecily spoke at length and then introduced us to Mr. Brewster, the middle school principal, who was my boss. My first impressions were favourable. An African-American, middle-aged, short, stocky, and bespectacled. All the new teachers now had to stand and introduce themselves, and I saw Brent's scribblings go into overdrive. When it was my turn, everybody laughed.
"Why did they laugh?"
I hissed to Joe as I sat down.
"Because you said you're English. Your accent gave that away in your first sentence. We're the only British here, as far as I can see."
Dr. Cecily again claimed the microphone, and her face stretched into an unnatural showbiz-like grin, eyes focused somewhere over our heads.
"And now, I want y'all to welcome the school's wonderful, talented, glorious owner, Mrs. Sherazy."
She led the applause, quickly taken up by the other 2 fat ladies, and obediently echoed by the rest of us. All eyes turned to the back of the auditorium. Chapter 4. ASS. Was this the school's owner? A hunched figure made her way slowly down the central aisle to the front, her eyes never lifting from the smooth parquet floor. I estimated that she was quite possibly an octogenarian, but the many facelifts had rendered her face immobile, and her eyebrows were arched in permanent surprise. A wig, made from impossibly thick, glossy black hair, cascaded over her shoulders. When she reached the microphone, she straightened her wig and began to read from her notes. I confess, I was fascinated by her.
"Welcome to a new year at ASS," she said.
"Where all students succeed,"
chanted the auditorium. Mrs. Sherrissey paused, but her expression didn't change, and she didn't look up. She carried on reading. These sentences were the longest I would ever hear her utter, as she normally restricted herself to just a few words at a time.
"For 10 years we were fortunate to have Mr. Denny as the high school principal. As you know, Mr. Denny had to leave the school because of poor health. I will now introduce the new high school principal, Miss Darina, who is from Canada."
I watched the other two fat ladies nudge each other, directing looks of sympathy at Dr. Cecily. It suddenly dawned on me that Dr. Cecily had expected the appointment, and her hostility to Darina stemmed from her disappointment in being overlooked. The fat lady's resentment of Darina now made sense to me. Darina stood to moderate applause and spoke a few breathless words of thanks into the microphone before returning it to Mrs. Sherrissey. I noticed that the three fat ladies did not join in the general applause that concluded Darina's speech.
"Things are going to change here at ASS," said Mrs. Sherrissey.
"Where all students succeed," chanted the auditorium.
"During the school day, no teacher is allowed outside the premises without a pass. The pass must be signed by either Miss Darina or Mr. Brewster. This is my school, and all teachers will follow my rules."
Clearly this was a formidable lady, a fact that would be reinforced in the months to come. We found her to be an astute businesswoman who never agreed to anyone's request for a salary increase, which often occurred, especially amongst the veteran teachers, no matter what the circumstances. Western teachers at other schools, we were told, earned so much more than those at ASS. Jo and I were quite satisfied with our conditions, and we felt our salaries were fair. However, she could be very forgiving. She rarely terminated a teacher's contract, even when the teacher was guilty of the most shocking crimes. I'll gloss over the dull parts of the meeting, and will report only the parts that made me sit up straighter. One, Mrs. Sherrissey's extraordinary wig, which had a tendency to slip forward, requiring constant adjusting. Two, the fact that there were a few last-minute problems with our timetables, or schedules, as the Americans call them. Three, that we would definitely be moving to our new apartments in a week or so. Eventually, Dr. Cecily wound up the meeting.
"We sure are looking forward to a productive new school year," she said, "here at ASS, where all students succeed," chanted the teachers,
Joe and I included. Mrs. Sherrissey bowed and departed to another round of celebrity applause, and we new teachers were taken to the library for an orientation meeting. Chaired again by the daunting Dr. Cecily, and assisted by Dawn and Rita, we were instructed on what to do, what never to do, and what to expect in Bahrain. Jo and I sat with our new friends, Colton and Jake, and as each nugget of information was delivered, our eyes met, in either amusement or disbelief. Ramadan was further explained. We were informed that during daylight hours, Muslims abstain from eating, drinking, including water, smoking, and marital sex.
"So non-marital sex is okay, then?"
said Joe. I kicked him under the table, and Colton and Joe sniggered. Dr. Cecily ignored Joe and continued.
"Muslims believe that every part of the body must be restrained during Ramadan," she said. "The tongue is not permitted idle gossip. Eyes must not look on anything unseemly. The ears must avoid hearing unsuitable or obscene words. And the feet must not lead one astray."
"Do all Muslims observe Ramadan?"
asked Andrea, a dark-haired, dark-eyed young teacher from Texas.
Sick people, travellers, the very young and very old, the mentally impaired and pregnant ladies are exempt,
Dr. Cecily answered. What about our students? I asked. Will they be fasting?
Most will be fasting and observing Ramadan,
she said.
Most won't even bother to come to school until it's over.
So we teach half classes to start with?
We sure do.
Joe leaned forward.
So what you were saying is that when school starts on Tuesday, hardly any of the kids will turn up.
That's right. And when Ramadan finishes, the Eid al-Fitr holiday begins, so there won't be any school anyway.
And when does Ramadan end?
The three fat ladies laughed.
That depends on the moon, explained Rita.
And whether you are Sunni or Shia,
said Dawn.
1% of the crescent moon has to be visible to the naked eye before Ramadan can end. Or 3%, depending on whether you are Sunni or Shia.
Which is just as well, because the schedule isn't ready,
muttered Dawn. This meeting was beginning to get interesting.
Some other things y'all should know,
Dr. Cecily went on.
The Ministry of Education is all-powerful, and the school and staff have to follow their rules, or the school will be closed down.
Dr. Cecily explained how the Ministry of Education's rules would affect us, and I made a mental list. In England, I was called Schindler because of my love of making lists, but judging by the following, I was in no danger of being given that nickname here in Bahrain. 1. Israel was completely missing from the curriculum and must never be mentioned by us. We must act as though it didn't exist. 2. The Holocaust must never be referred to, as the government does not recognize that it ever happened. It must be skipped by all history teachers. 3. School textbooks sometimes had pages glued together to protect students from
offensive material.
4. In textbooks containing photographs of people dressed scantily or wearing shorts, expect to find clothes added and coloured in by hand. Joe, Jake, Colton and I gaped and exchanged more glances. Was this for real? What were we doing here in this strange place? But there were more surprises. 5. The older generation are highly respected. I hoped that would stand Joe and me in good stead in the classroom. 6. Bribery is commonplace. Both students and their parents have been known to offer money, goods, even cars, in exchange for higher grades. 7. Never complain about being kept waiting. It's very rude. 8. Boys and girls do not date. Instead, they go out in groups, chaperoning each other. At discos, girls and boys dance separately, protected from each other by a barrier. 9. Hand-holding by members of the opposite sex or any public signs of affection, even between husband and wife, are frowned upon. 10. However, hand-holding by members of the same gender is perfectly acceptable. Men often walk along holding hands. By now, Joe, Jake, Colton and I were listening with our mouths hanging open. But there were even more extraordinary customs to observe. 11. Never show the soles of your feet, as it's regarded as a terrible insult. 12. Beware. Many Muslims believe that Western ladies are easy because of the way they dress. Andrea snorted at that one. Joe said, "Do you mean they're not?" and received another kick from me under the table. 13. Never pass anything to anyone using your left hand. The right hand is used for eating and drinking, whilst the left is reserved for bodily hygiene, and thus considered unclean. 14. Never compliment anybody on a possession, as Muslims will feel obliged to give it to you, whatever the value. Jake leaned into Joe.
"Nice watch,"
he said, pointing at Joe's shiny new timepiece. We never bothered with watches in Iloilo, but felt we needed them now.
"Thank you, it's new,"
said Joe. Then started laughing as Jake opened his palm, ready to accept the gift that Joe was supposed to make.
"I really like this,"
said Colton, fingering Joe's shirt collar.
"Okay, y'all,"
said Dr. Cecily, frowning at the hilarity at our end of the long table.
"Why don't you go off and take a look round the school and find your own classrooms?"
She closed the meeting, and we all wandered off.
"Well, Mr. Rena told me that I'm a floater and I haven't been given my own classroom," said Joe.
"Makes me feel like something left in a lavatory,"
he added under his breath.
"Let's go and find your room in the middle school."
I agreed, picturing my classroom to be similar to the many I'd taught him back in the UK. How mistaken I was. We passed Brent in the corridor, scribbling in his notebook.
"Hi, Brent," said Joe. "Have you found your classroom?"
"Hi, no, I'm a floater," said Brent, not looking up.
He frantically flicked the pages in his notebook. "Excuse me, please. What are your names, please?" We passed through the double swing doors into the middle school. The ground floor housed all the grade six classes, so I knew my classroom would be somewhere here. The first room was a small staff room. A bank of elderly-looking computers lined the walls. In the centre was a large work table. Every chair was occupied by an Arabic member of staff, all women, all veiled. They were all speaking at once, and the noise level was high. I understood not a word and hurriedly backed out. The first classroom was large, the walls decorated with maps and bulletin boards. A foam mattress leaned against the back wall. "Well," I said, "this must be the geography room, but if my classroom is anything like this, I certainly won't complain. They even provide a bed for naps between lessons." We walked further down the corridor and found my classroom. "Miss Vicky, Grade 6 English," was signed above the door. It was sandwiched between the principal's office and another that housed the school's computer control system. "Well, this is it," I said to Joe. "This is going to be my home for the next year." I opened the door and looked in. "Oh, my."
"Oh,"
echoed Joe. The room was tiny and bleak. At the front stood a ramshackle teacher's desk with a whiteboard behind. The room had no cupboards, just an ancient bookcase with bowed shelves. The battered students' desks had already been set out. They were of the combo type, with a writing surface fixed to the chair. I counted 22. They were so closely packed that I wondered how the children would reach the ones at the back without having to climb over the ones in front. I could already see that I wouldn't be able to wander around the classroom to check on pupils' work. In fact, there wasn't even space for me to write on the whiteboard, as the front desks nosed up against the wall. "There must be some mistake," I said. "Perhaps they're just storing extra desks in here."
"Well, at least you have a classroom," said Joe. "At least you're not a floater like me. And those two big windows let in lots of light."
That was true. The barred windows had no blinds and looked out onto the courtyard.
"I think you want to cover those windows," said a voice from the doorway. "You buy paper. You stick it all over windows."
Joe and I swung round to see who was speaking. Chapter 5. Friends. In the doorway stood a figure, the owner of the voice. She smiled shyly and stepped forward.
"I'm Hawa," she said. "I teach grade 6 math, and my classroom is opposite yours. I am the meanest teacher."
We smiled at each other, and I sensed a friend and ally. Hawa was petite, graceful, and dressed in a beautiful, shimmering turquoise abaya, her hijab decorated with sequins and pearls. In all the time I spent in Bahrain, I never saw her wear the same outfit twice. Joe and I introduced ourselves.
"The meanest teacher?" I asked. "Oh, yes." She giggled, and her pretty oriental eyes shone. "You see? You see?"
Hawa looked more like a butterfly than the meanest teacher, but I didn't say so.
"You say I should cover the windows?" I asked.
"Yes. When the high school come out for their break, all the kids, they not listen to you. They watch big kids. And big kids, they knock on glass and make bad faces. better you cover the windows with paper.
Well, I'll leave you to it, said Joe. I'd better go and explore the high school. I'll see you both later.
He left, and Hawa and I got to know each other better. Hawa was Malaysian and had already worked at ASS for 4 years. She had settled on the island, her husband worked in Manama, and her children attended the British school. I explained that